Yeah, I wanted to mention too, whatever that is that's been going around, as they say, I started having a runny nose and whatnot on Tuesday, and I've still been kind of run down and obviously got something going on. So I love you dearly, but I'm going to impose a quasi-quarantine on myself this morning, so I'll kind of hang out up here in the front, I think, leave everybody alone, lest I'm still contagious in some manner, but been feeling kind of peaked myself last little while. So, with that said, let's go ahead and run on into John chapter 7. Brethren, I just love these chapters, 6, 7, and 8. That's because I guess I'm a naturally feisty kind of a guy, I suppose. In John chapter 6 and 7 and 8, Jesus is just constantly involved in verbal fisticuffs with the religious leaders of his time. It is encouraging, I guess, for most preachers especially, but I hope it's encouraging for everyone to see how vigorously he defends the truth, how pointedly he fights for that truth. He is, to some extent, our example. We are certainly not the Messiah ourselves, but from his life we have a shining example, a perfect example of what we are to be. And when it comes to false doctrines, when it comes to immorality, and when it comes to simply confronting worldliness, Jesus, of course, is the best. And so that has been going on now throughout all of chapter 6. Pharisees were after him. Their ire has been rising. We have seen last week with chapter 7 that they've come to the point now where they are very vigorously attempting, seeking a way to seize and then to kill him. And so Jesus points that out, in case you were not here last week or the week before. First, in verse 19 on page 130, John 7:19, "Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carries out the law? Why do you seek to kill me?" Then at the very top of page 131, "For a second time, some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, 'Is this not the man whom they are seeking to kill?'" Skipping down to verse 30, "They were seeking therefore to seize him, and no man laid his hand on him, because his hour had not yet come." Toward the very bottom of that page, 131 in John 7, in verse 44, "Some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid hands on him." Turning the page to 133 in John now 8 and verse 20, "These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one seized him because his hour had not yet come." Then on page 134 in John 8, verses 37 and again in 40, "I know you are Abraham's offspring, yet you seek to kill me." And finally, number 7 on page 135, at the last verse of that chapter 8 is verse 59, "Therefore they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." So throughout these chapters, which we've been now looking at for some 3 weeks, we want to remember that there is extreme anger and opposition against Jesus. There is a murderous rage. In every word he says in full knowledge of that fact. And so he's not trying to placate anybody. He's not trying to turn their wrath away. He's not trying, you know, somehow to persuade people to like him. He's not about the business of thinking a glad handing and let's just all get along, you know, is a good idea at all. So there's a lesson for us there, to say the least. And then the second theme I pointed out last week, and won't go through all of those again, but it is interesting that there's this geographical idea that also runs through both chapters 7 and 8, where Jesus is from and where Jesus is going. So, just for example, on page 131 in John 7, at the top of the page at verse 27, "We know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from. Jesus therefore cried out in the temple, teaching and saying, 'You both know me and know where I am from. And I've not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. I know him because I am from him.'" Jesus is from Bethlehem. He's not from any physical place. But he's from heaven, actually. And then as you skip down into chapter 7 at verse 33, Jesus said, "For a little while longer I'm with you, then I go to him who sent me. You'll seek me and shall not find me, and where I am you cannot come. Jews therefore said to one another, 'Where does this man intend to go that we shall not find him?' He's not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? What is the statement that he said? 'You will seek me and will not find me, and where I am you cannot come.' And then finally, in 41 on that page, though there are many more in the next couple of pages, in verse 41, others were saying, this is the Christ. Still others were saying, surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the Scripture said that the Christ comes from the offspring of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was? So they're wrestling with Jesus' origination. And well, they might. Was Jesus physically born in Bethlehem? Sure. Does he then come from Bethlehem? Yes. Does that satisfy Micah's prophecy that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem? Well, obviously. But is that where Jesus is from in the sense that any other human being is from some city? I'm from Inglewood, California. Inglewood Hospital is where I was born. No, he's from heaven, and that's what he's trying to say. And I'm going home. I'm going back. I'm returning to the Father. And it is for this reason that you want to kill me. You will not accept that I am the Son of God as well as the Son of Man. You won't accept it. That is your fault. And Jesus is not about to relent in pressing that point. So we ended last week in verse 44. Some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid hands on him. The officers, therefore, they're the ones that had been sent, came to the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they said to them, why did you not bring him? And the officers answered, never did a man speak the way this man speaks. So they made up their minds they would obey the religious leaders. We'll go grab Jesus and we'll arrest him and we'll see that you guys then are allowed to kill him. But when they tried, they were in awe of the manner in which he behaved. They were amazed at the wisdom that came from his teaching and preaching. And so when they came to this man, they were just helpless. That he was a superior person. And it was ridiculous when you got there to think about trying to murder such an individual. So you can just see them there kind of helplessly hanging their arms at their side and saying, we just can't do this. And I suppose it would be like being sent to arrest a three-year-old for a capital offense. You know, it would just be so inappropriate, so ridiculous, that whether the authorities had sent you or not, you just couldn't do it. So it must have been awfully impressive, because these men come back and just admit their failure. They have only one thing to say. Never man so spake. Don't you wish you could have sat at the feet of Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount or somewhere else and listened to him preach? It must have been awesome. We are told in another place that he spoke with authority that was unlike the Pharisees. And so there was something about the presentation that came across as powerful, convicting, as otherworldly, as divine. They knew it was just superior in authority. And you remember, of course, that this is going to all happen again when in the garden they come to arrest him. And you remember the little exchange there, whom you seek? Well, it's Jesus. All right, well, I'm him. And what do? They actually fall backwards in that case. And so at that moment, Jesus is presenting himself in a manner that is so very different and impressive on a regular human being that for a second time, the arresting officers are just helpless. Hands at their sides, hang their heads, and go back home. Well, this, of course, enrages the people that have sent them. They're failing at their very job. And so in 47, verse 47, top of 132, Pharisees therefore answered them, you've not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude which does not know the law is accursed. Well, that's quite an outburst. See how superior we are. But in 50, Nicodemus said to them, he who came to him before, being one of them, that is, he's a Pharisee, our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it? And they answered and said to him, you're not also, and there's that geography, from Galilee, are you? search and see. No prophet arises out of Galilee. These men have lost their minds. They want him dead. They don't care what anybody says. And Nicodemus, he's a part of this Sanhedrin. He is therefore a respected member among them. But he is a man who's been the one man, apparently, that's been doing what none of the rest will. Investigate. Where was Nicodemus in the third chapter of this same gospel? Came by night. What did he do? Jesus, what are you? That's the loose paraphrase you'll ever hear. What are you about? That is, I believe, an honest inquiry. And we will find out here that it must have been an impressive meeting. And now as he's contrasting that authority, that powerful presence, in the face of the Pharisees' reaction here, he just asks them the simple question. Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him. Has Jesus been arrested? No. Has Jesus been tried? No. Apparently, have any of these other Pharisees even done as much as Nicodemus had to go ask him a couple of questions? No. So they're absolutely certain that their understanding of the scripture, that no prophet comes from Galilee, demonstrates that everybody else is ignorant. This is impossible. And Nicodemus here, brother, if we read between the lines a little bit, Nicodemus is in danger here, as were those officers. When in verse 47 to the officers they said, "You've not also been led astray." What is that? That's not just a question. That's a threat. That's a warning. We sent you to arrest him because we believe that he has been led astray and is leading others astray. Are you one of them? Well, brother, that puts you on the receiving end of getting arrested. And now, when Nicodemus asks, "Is this legal?" And the answer is, "Absolutely not." Then in 52, the answer said, "You're not also from Galilee, are you? Search to see no prophet." What are they accusing him of? Being a believer to some extent. You're acting like you're from the same area, like you would be friendly and brotherly to this guy. It, again, is a veiled threat. Not just the opposition, but, you know, the threat itself is just growing and growing, not just wrath directed at Jesus, but at anybody that's around him. So these men, they are dangerous, to say the very least. Now, of course, that brings us to the parenthetical information, that is, the last verse of chapter 7, and then the first 11 verses of chapter 8. So, as you're on page 132, we want to read the footnote at the very bottom of the page. This section probably records an historic incident in the life of Christ, but one preserved by Christian tradition and not by the writer of this gospel. Evidence from more reliable textual sources denies this incident a place in John's gospel. Therefore, it is impossible to discover the correct chronological placement of this encounter. So likely, as they've done with the harmony here, but most of you will have in your regular Bibles some sort of brackets or indentation or, you know, some way of marking these 12 verses as being suspect as to whether or not they belong in the gospel. Now, the most important thing to remember here, brethren, is this. There's not one word in these 12 verses that contradicts anything anywhere else in Scripture. That's point number one. Point number two, I'll give you two. And the second thing is, if this material does not belong in John's gospel, some later scribe added it. Okay? It also does not change anything about the life of Christ. So this is one of the extremely few
But one of the two largest places in the New Testament where we do have a very legitimate concern, a lot of manuscripts don't have those verses. Some do. The ones that do, we have reason to suspect, you know, had less reliability. The transcribers and the scribes may have taken the liberty to add there something to what the original author of the gospel had himself put down. It has kind of the earmarks of an addition. Now, we talked about this so many times, I don't spend a lot of time on it, but brethren, only this and Mark 16 are sizable, the long ending of Mark 16, are sizable sections of Scripture where you've got more than just a single word or a single verse. This is an entire event. And like Mark 16, there's not just sizable, but very important events that some manuscripts did not include. And I have absolutely no doubt that the long ending of Mark 16 belongs there, that it is original. Can't tell at all. I have to agree with the commentators here at the bottom of the page. It's just really tough to know with regard to John 7, 53 through 8, 11. And so what we've got is a circumstance where it doesn't change anything. Take it or leave it. But what these particular scholars suggest is the event probably happened. It just was not penned in the flow of John's original gospel. And then some years later, somebody copying John's gospel decided they were going to take an actual event that really happened and on their own authority, not the writer of the gospel's authority, they're going to add it here at the end of chapter 7, make it the start of chapter 8. So, again, there's no problem. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't cast any shadow over biblical reliability. If anything, it's quite the opposite. You can tell when something, remember, extremely small number of places, a couple of handful of verses. In fact, I've heard it said that out of your entire Bible, so just look at, not this is just the Gospels, but look at your entire Bible, there is less than one full page of print that we question, that we really wonder about. So out of thousands of pages, there's one page where we do have to scratch our heads and say, well, you know, we're not sure. The manuscript evidence doesn't agree. There are 5,000 plus New Testament manuscripts. And when we have a passage like this one where it looks like maybe it wasn't in the original, that gives you confidence that we are finding what the original text was. It shouldn't cause us to lose confidence, but rather to gain. So we always study this. It is likely that it actually took place. It certainly comports with everything else that Jesus never did. And so in verse 53, everyone went to his home. And in chapter 8 and verse 1 there on page 132, Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people were coming to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?" And they were saying this, testing him, in order that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped down with his finger, wrote on the ground. So, everybody on the planet knows about this particular event. We've all read it. This takes place in the temple area somewhere, up on that 37-acre Temple Mount area that Herod had created. These Pharisees are there for one and only one reason. What is it? Cause to seize and kill Jesus. So see if you can figure it out. Why would this woman caught in adultery give them a blunt instrument that they could use to kill Jesus? What would it be? The charge is, will you follow the law of Moses? Did Moses teach that an adulterer should be put to death? Absolutely. Would that our government was still practicing that. God knew what he was doing.
It'd be a better country if we were still doing the same thing. But did the Romans, who had conquered Palestine and were ruling it at this moment as a puppet nation, allow the Jews to put anybody to death? No. They had to come and plead their case before the Roman authorities. So they're setting Jesus up. If you say, no, let's not put her to death, well, then you're breaking Moses' law and apparently fearing the Romans. If you say, yes, let's put her to death, we can run and tell the Romans and hopefully have a case against you with them. So we've got you caught between Jewish law and Roman law, or at least that's what they're trying to pull off. So Jesus stoops down with his finger, he writes on the ground. Didn't say anything in the world. Believe it or not, I've been absolutely amazed at how, you know, free of all conscience people have. But I've seen people write about what it was that he scratched in the dirt. They think they know. Does the scripture tell us what he was doing there? No. And so speculating on what he actually wrote, you know, is really just ridiculous. I don't know what he was writing, but he was ignoring them. And so in 7, when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." That's what their death penalties, that's what their one death penalty was about. You would stone a person to death. And then he just looked down again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. He was left alone and the woman where she had been in the midst. Straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. From now on, sin no more." Now, this is fascinating, okay? And it does create a bit of a conundrum for us. Does Jesus have to keep Moses' law? Yes, he does. He must keep every single law. If he does not keep the law that he's under as a Jew, then what does he become? A sinner. And if he's guilty of sin, can he die in our place for our sins? No. So that has to be, you know, accounted for. He had to keep the law. So what's going on here? If they caught her in the act of adultery and they're telling the truth, then what should they do? They should be going to the Romans and saying, "We have a capital offense. We are now asking your permission to put this woman to death. Does Jesus do that?" No, he does not. However, when you have a capital offense, what do you also need? Witnesses. Can you kill someone, that is, execute someone, with only one witness? No, you have to have more than one. Now, brethren, where there are obvious ways that this might be all breaking down, is that one, they might be lying. Though based on her response to Jesus, it does not look like they were. Okay? But number two, even if she was guilty of the adultery, and they say she was caught in the act, does that mean that the witnesses, the ones that caught her in the act, are present at this moment? It does not. It could be that these Pharisees, they caught this woman somehow, set her up, maybe, I don't know what they did, you know, but the actual witnesses aren't there. These guys rushed off with the woman, she was caught in the act, you know, and they're setting Jesus up. There's no way to tell from the text that the witnesses themselves were there. Without witnesses, even if you're guilty, can you be executed? No. That's a very important provision in the law and prevents a lot of, you know, sinful murders by people setting other folks up and getting them put away when, it's a personal vendetta. And so we just can't tell quite what's going on right here. But be that as it may, now that these men have been told, okay, let's do what Moses' law says, and those that are without sin be the first to cast a stone, what were they then forced to do? Admit what? They had sins of their own. And so they're kind of forced to this, brethren. Are they likely to admit that they have sins of their own? The very word Pharisee means separated. Their whole thing is, we're free from sin, we're higher than everybody else, we're separated from you all. You know, that's all the case. But what did Moses' law say about a capital offense? The people who are the witnesses are to what? Cast the first stone. The text in the Old Testament says that. So if you're going to bring in a capital case, and you're going to plead for the execution of somebody for their sins, you have to be prepared to hurl the first rock. That's tough to do. You have to be awfully committed to the law, to these circumstances. Well, it's not off base at all, and that's the next thing to bring up. What Sherry is suggesting here, if you catch this woman in the act, then what must there obviously necessarily be? There's another party, isn't there? Is that guy there? No.
Maybe he was.
Well, but it doesn't appear like it. See, it doesn't seem so. We brought this woman. But you're right. I mean, it may be, and it's just not mentioned, but it sure doesn't look like it. And so that's another very important factor in all of this. Are they doing this legally? Really not. Are they willing to cast the first stone? No. And it may not have so much to do with having to admit that they are sinners as it is that they're just really squeamish and reluctant about actually casting the first stone. And so they are defeated. They completely back off. Now, has Jesus kept the law? He has. He sought the witnesses. He has sought to practice the law exactly the way that it should be practiced. What is his question to the woman in verse 10? There's two of them. Where are they? And did no one what? Okay. So kangaroo court that it was there a conviction? No. So Jesus has kept the law. And so they come to him, you know, with this test case. He did what the law said to do. They backed down. Jesus has broke no law. Now then, you know, we have, you know, the final and end result there, though. In verse 11, she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. From now on, sin no more."
Now, this is true that Jesus knows the end from the beginning and can read minds. He knows whether she's guilty or not. But he was not an eyewitness to this. He wasn't there, and they brought her. You know, and so he's really not a witness in that sense. And so I'm not going to condemn you either. But this is what leads me to suspect that she actually was caught in the act of adultery. He told her to sin. Then what's the two next words? No more. So that looks like an implicit recognition. She had sinned. Let's not do this again. So sin no more.
Now certainly Jesus also has the right to forgive anybody of sin. Under that old law. So, did the event take place? Probably. Was it in John's original text? Probably not. Does it change anything? No. Does it in any way justify, condone, or allow adultery? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've dealt with a number of adultery cases through the years, and one that was very spectacular involved an elder who'd been involved in an adultery over the course of 35 years. And, you know, he did exactly the same thing that I've seen time and time again. And I didn't even point it out while we were working through this and working through it with the various families that were involved in all of that. It was actually one of his, his son's wife who made the particular comment I'm about to tell you about right here. But sure enough, he goes and he cites this passage as a reason that he ought to be, you know, his adultery ought to just be ignored. And she says, everybody cites that passage when they get caught in adultery. And good for her. This is not any excuse. This passage hasn't got anything to do with somebody else and whether or not they have been guilty and what ought to be done with them. This is a unique case where the Pharisees are breaking the law to try to set Jesus up so that they can kill him. Now, unless those are your circumstances, if you get caught up in adultery, this passage isn't addressing your circumstances. Now, coincidentally, and only coincidentally, I didn't plan for this, but last Sunday we spent quite a bit of time on Romans chapter 13. Are Christians to obey the laws of the land that they're under? Yes. Were these Jews to obey the laws of the land that they were under? That put them under two laws. They were under Moses' law, but they were also what? Under Roman law. Now today, we're under the New Testament. That's true. Are we not also underneath United States legal code? Yes, we are. Do the citizens of this United States have any more right to put somebody to death themselves than the Jews did under Roman law? We have no such right today. Now, brethren, I'm fully convinced that the moral requirements of the old law are still as valid today as they ever were. God's penalty for adultery is death. That's what ought to be done. And that's never changed. God's penalty for murder is death. And that is what ought to be done. God's penalty for homosexual behavior is death. And that's what ought to be done. But if you're living under Roman law or you're living under the United States law, and we as Christians are commanded to obey that law, and under that law they've taken away this death penalty, then will these various capital offenses, which are every bit as valid today as they ever were, will they be practiced by us? See, no, not in the culture and in the times in which we are. Be a better nation if it was, but, you know, we don't hold those reins of government. We are subject to Romans 13. So we must obey, and therefore, in our country, virtually every murderer gets off scot-free. We hardly ever have a death penalty. Now, Texas is renowned for doing it the most, I guess, you know, and good for them. But from Old Testament or New, God's condemnation of murder explains that it brings a curse upon the entire nation. So when you don't put people to death for murder, that's not compassion. That's not mercy. That's not following John 8. What that is a dereliction of duty in governmental authority that brings a curse upon the land. Their blood cries out from the ground. And that is extremely worrisome, brethren. It really ought to be. God brings down nations for just such as that. In our time, surely will come. So you go back and you look at all capital offenses of the Old Testament. I can't find a single one that would not still be valid today. And under a government that fully understood its rights and responsibilities, we would use the same capital punishment for the same capital offenses that you find in your Old Testament and in your New. This passage does not do away with capital punishment in the least. Any comment or question on that? A couple of them here. Carol first.
I'm thinking about the quote that says that a child was disrespectful to his parents, mm-hmm, and that he needed to be put to death. But again, you have a trial, and then you also have the ox that gored a person the first time it's an accident, the second time that's punishable by death because you knew you needed to put that person, that animal, to death. So it's many sins that were punishable by death, but always in a trial situation. So you had to go to whoever was the authority at the time and have the trial and then have the punishment. just say that person did that and stone them on the spot. That wasn't the way it was done.
That's absolutely correct. That's exactly right. Bill, I think, was another one who had a hand up. I don't know. I wasn't on the committee, but the reason you find it in most Bibles is because it's like one of those deals where we're at 55-45. The predominant textual evidence suggests that it wasn't in the original, but it's so close to the margin that you can't just say emphatically we're really sure it, you know, it's not there. So they almost every text will include it. Doesn't that text include it with a footnote? they keep putting it in because they just aren't that sure. So, you know, I can't answer. I've never been on a translating committee, but it only demonstrates how close to that line it is. We're just not sure, so we put it in, and then people can deal with it on their own. Anybody else over here? Go ahead, Carl. But in Romans 13, he's talking about the laws of man. You have to obey the laws of man. There are many foolish and ridiculous laws. Every once in a while, you'll see these articles, and they'll say, did you know that it's still on the books? And this is what Carl's talking about. There are cities, you know, where you can wind up in jail, I guess, if you spit on the sidewalk, if you drop bubble gum. There's all these different kinds of things, you know. We just think that's ridiculous. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. As a citizen under God's instruction, are we to pass judgment on the laws? Or is it instead our responsibility to be in submission to them? And let me add this one thing, which I think is so critical. I teach on this all the time. Brethren, is it possible ever to have submission when you agree with the person who's asking you to do something? When is the only time that submission can exist? Because you disagree with the law or the circumstances or whatever that it is. Now, in Romans 13, God tells us to be in submission. To say the least, the Emperor Nero, who was reigning when that book was written, was not the best lawmaker the world ever saw. You know, the guy was a madman. And so he was doing insanity and much murder at the time. Paul still said, what? Be in subjection. So what is the only time that you can be in subjection? Because you see that you disagree with the law. You think it's foolish. You think it's silly. And maybe it is. But it's still there. You know, my favorite illustration, this is military law. This is a true story. I read this in Reader's Digest probably 35 years ago. There was a set of stairs that every night had to have a guard posted. And so every night there was a guard there all night long. They relieved them in 4-hour shifts, you know, and these guys had to stand there all night long posted at the foot of the stairs. This had been going on for years and years and years. And finally one guy went to his commanding officer and he just asked the question, why are we, and it seems to me as when it was like the staff sergeant who was making up the duty roster, and he was having a problem finding personnel or something, and he wanted to know, why are we posting this guard at the foot of the stairs? Well, nobody knew, and so they're digging and digging and digging, and then finally they found it. Oh, look at that. It was like 15 years ago. They painted the stairs. So we posted a guard that night to keep anybody from walking on it. They had to be directed over to the other stairs at the other end of the building. And then what did they forget to do?
So for years and years and years, they're posted a guard every night to protect people from walking on dry feet. Now, is that silly? Yeah, it's just an oversight. It's ridiculous. But can a soldier just say, well, I've decided I'm not going to do my duty? This seems silly to me. I don't like it. I don't see any reason to be here at these stairs. I have no job description. I don't know what to do. No, your job is to be in submission. So later they find out it's stupid. It seems stupid. Was stupid. But what's your job? Be in submission. Stand guard duty.
Can I actually just clarify what the question was?
I can't hear you.
Can I actually just clarify what the question was you had for us? I
missed it. What we're dealing with is whether or not death penalties, as defined by the Bible, ought to be practiced today.
Well,
you know, I'm saying yes, they should.
Well, what I'm wondering about that, though, is when Jesus said, let you who cast the first stone go ahead and fulfill that law and that commandment, but where's the love when we say that they should be killed for what they do? I thought that we were following the example of Jesus when he did that. We're trying to walk in the ways of the Lord. And the person that we kill when we do that, we take away their chance to actually change their ways. And they can change their walk in life and be with the Lord. I don't see where the love is. It kind of angers me when I hear people say that, but I know everybody's entitled to their opinion. And
there's love, and then there's justice. And in justice, there's also forgiveness, you know, or guilt, innocence, and, you know, a decision is rendered. It is never love to say, we're just going to set aside all the laws because I like you so much, or I feel like I ought to show compassion. So you commit a, let me finish my brother. You commit a murder, that is not an act of love. You commit a murder and you shed innocent blood. God goes out of his way throughout the Old Testament to say, that is a crime for which there's only one possible thing to do. That blood must be atoned. That is how precious human life is. And so it is not love to say to the family of the victims, why we love the perpetrator so much that we're just not going to do what God said to do and practice the death penalty on the perpetrator. It is not love that says, well, I got a Ted Bundy here. He's killed 12-year-old little girls, polyclass. He's a serial killer. But my love is so great that I'm going to put him in prison. It is not love to put him in prison at all. The Jews never even had prison. And so in the old law, and you find people being in prison, Romans are doing it, but not in the law.
But then who has the ability, when Jesus said, let you who cast the first stone, who has the ability to do that?
Nobody would be without sin. But in this case, I think Jesus used that expression because he also did not have a proper trial taking place. They did not have the other party who should also be put to death. I think, as we were talking, likely the witnesses were not there. And they had come with evil intent, had nothing to do with the woman, had everything to do with Jesus. And Jesus is not a witness and he's not one of the lawyers. He has no authority to cast a stone himself, and he is without sin. He's following the law.
Right.
But the law includes capital punishment. It is not an act of love because Jesus repeatedly said in John 14 and 15, it is the principle of all the Old Testament. If you love God, what's the proof? Keep his commandments. God commands that innocent blood that has been shed must be atoned by the death of the perpetrator. It is rebellion if you say, well, I'm just not going to do it. But in this case, they were misbehaving. It was not the end of the death penalty. It was the revealing of their own sin, but not the end of death penalties. I'll finish with this. I didn't hear a bell. In Romans 13, and I think it's verse 7, the most critical and salient part of all of this is in Romans 13, 7. That's New Testament legislation long after Christ was raised from the dead. He says that the government does not bear the sword in vain. What do you do with a sword, capital punishment. You put people to death with it. You don't spank them with it. You put them to death with it. So Paul confirmed that governments have the right to the death penalty and ought to be practiced. Not us, but the government.
I appreciate that, Larry.
Yes. Yeah.
And they didn't have jails, but they did have sanctuary cities where you could escape to. You still had a trial if you weren't guilty of something that was a capital punishment. You had to stay in that for, until the death of the high priest. But if you stuck your nose out and tried to go somewhere, the relatives of the offended party could kill you on the spot.
So on the spot. That's the law. Jimmy?
There is a prison gate. We read a long time ago. So why did they have the prison gate?
Wasn't the Jews' prison. It was the Romans.
It was in the temple.
That's why I say only in Moses' law there's no prison. They didn't have jail. The Jews didn't. They were under governments that had it, but not the Jews. Thanks so much.